Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Friday, October 30th. Politics and the CDC, or how to depoliticize the Centers for Disease Control and other federal health agencies and make them as effective as possible with the next wave of the pandemic rising. What is the proper role of the CDC? It is a science agency in a political environment, the government. What's the role of the CDC and other federal health offices? And what will the Trump administration or a possible Biden administration do differently if they win the election? Joining me now is Andy Slavitt, former administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under President Obama. He is host of the podcast In the Bubble and author of the forthcoming book, Preventable, the inside story of how leadership failures, politics, and selfishness doomed the U.S. coronavirus response. Andy, thank you so much for coming on with us at this busy time. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be here.
Where do you start your book?
I actually think that for many Americans, the experience of January, February, and March was a bit surreal. There were various steps in time when people realized that things were going to be very, very different. Obviously, the president knew much sooner than he let on. But I try to take people back to the point where they experienced this discovery and the various events that caused us to see what was going on. And then I go back into the White House and show what was going on based on a lot of the conversations that I've been having and I'm currently having with the team in there and governors and others around the country as everybody reacted differently at different speeds and in different ways.
Let me play a clip from March. And if we go back 2 years to 2018, there's been a lot of confusion about what happened to something called the Global Health Security and Biodefense Unit within the National Security Council. But for people who are asking, what does that have to do with coronavirus? Back in 2018, that unit ceased operations. And when people talk about a pandemic response team, that's who they're referring to when they say Trump disbanded a pandemic response team. So back in March, Yamiche Alcindor, White House correspondent for the PBS NewsHour, asked the president about it at a press conference.
You said that you don't take responsibility, but you did disband the White House pandemic office, and the officials that were working in that office left this administration abruptly. So what responsibility do you take to that? And the officials that worked in that office said that that the White House lost valuable time because that office wasn't disbanded. What do you make of that?
Well, I just think it's a nasty question, because what we've done is, and Tony has said numerous times that we've saved thousands of lives because of the quick closing. And when you say me, I didn't do it.
What did he do? What didn't he do, Andy?
Look, if you go back to the last number of presidents, going as far back as we can even think, certainly Barack Obama, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, these were people who were all very much briefed on what was going on with the threat of a pandemic and a coronavirus, and knew that it was one of our existential threats. Trump, I think, just kind of in his contrarian nature, dismissed that. And he also doesn't pay a lot of attention to things that aren't serving him closely. So I wouldn't be surprised if when Bolton got rid of that pandemic response unit, he barely noticed. Or it's quite possible he said, "What are all these people doing?" As he said at one point, "I don't like people sitting around doing nothing." But it's clear that whether it was negligence or whether it was more active, he disbanded one of our core abilities, both there and within the CDC, to get the intelligence to allow us to respond.
When we talk about the Centers for Disease Control, is it fair to say that it's always been influenced by various corporate and political interests, and it's never been completely independent? And if you agree with that statement, to what degree was it true in the past, and how has it changed under Trump?
Well, I think the CDC has historically been one of the least influenced bodies in our government. In some respects, the wide berth given to the CDC and allowing them to, you know, they're headquartered in Atlanta. You know, it's quite a distance from things that most presidents actually care about or think about. So White Houses tend not to interfere other than, you know, picking one person to run the CDC, which is often typically an expert in public health. What happened here almost from the start was different. Robert Redfield, who is, I think, a nice person and means well, was a person who was and the AIDS epidemic was believed that abstinence was the solution. Is a favorite of the religious right, not known for his public health chops, and then Trump put in five other political appointees, which has never happened in the history of the CDC. Four other ones, five total political appointees in the CDC, and in no time before then there had been more than one. So from the start, he was viewing this that way. I think in particular because Trump likes to control the message, and CDC, one of their main roles, is communication.
Yeah, and we've had communication at cross purposes between Redfield, even with the shortcomings that you just identified with respect to him, and the president. The president says a vaccine will be available very soon. Redfield says a vaccine would not likely be available until sometime in 2021. The CDC put out the recent advisory that coronavirus is more aerosolized than officially had been said before. That is, it'll linger in a room where people had been for longer than maybe first thought. The Trump administration said, no, it doesn't. And they withdrew that advisory and then they put it back. So talk about that. Talk about that communication role. And to what degree has the CDC been politicized and is now an unreliable source of information for the public, in your opinion?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Brian, just some context is when you have a novel pandemic, until you have a vaccine or very reliable antivirals, communication is your medicine. That's the way we should think about this, because it is the ability to control the virus is entirely controlled by getting a consistent message out to the public. And as I go into into the book, the scientists he has, whether it's in CDC or FDA or other places, they only lasted because they're either weak or loyal. But what is interesting is that and Anthony Fauci is an exception, and Deborah Birx becomes an exception. But by the end, he so crushes dissent. He crushes dissent, as you said, in the case of the CDC. He does it in the case of the FDA. He does it with Nancy Messonnier, Rick Bright. That eventually, even Robert Redfield and Stephen Hahn, who are not, you know, political figures, are not paid to be brave. They certainly don't want to take on the president. Even they finally just say, you know, my scientific credentials don't allow me to not at least find some way to say what I think is going on. And about a few weeks ago, Trump really lost all control when the FDA went ahead and put out guidelines on the vaccine that were against what his wishes were. The CDC essentially said, you know, there are too many of us scientists. We might as well just keep talking. And I think the thing I want to remind people of is, if you take away the one or two political people at top of the FDA or the CDC, the agencies are the same. And they're not perfect, but they're the best we have, and they are protectors of democracy. They're the protectors of our health. They're the institutions that we need. And so we should take whatever concerns or frustrations we have about the politicization of them and reform them, but not throw them out. And yes, they made mistakes. We can point to CDC, several big mistakes the CDC and the FDA made, even irrespective of the politics. And that's going to happen when you have a novel virus. It's not cause to lose confidence in these institutions. It's cause to see how we can make them better.
And maybe the biggest problem that the CDC had came at the beginning of the coronavirus, let me say that I mean by that the biggest problem not related to politicization by the White House, they bungled the early testing rollout, right? They distributed this test that was supposed to be used around the country to help contain the virus before it really got out in the land, and the test didn't work. Did that have anything to do with politics?
Only loosely. I mean, you can argue that when one of the things that President Trump did was he shut down a bunch of our intelligence offices overseas, including dramatic reductions in China and in other places. And he also, a number of people left the CDC, a number of good people left. And so you could say indirectly that happened because of Trump. But that's, I don't think that gets them fully off the hook. They made a number of mistakes, one of which you described was a really critical mistake. But almost bigger mistake was that we had early on, and I go into this in the book in Preventable, we had people around the country, labs around the country who were volunteering to roll out their own tests. And we would have gotten tests out much more rapidly. This is what they did in South Korea. And the CDC decided no, it was only going to use its own tests. And the FDA decided only this CDC test would be approved. And so, yes, there was a mistake in that test. But the other problem was that they put all their eggs in one basket. Instead of saying every lab in the country, go ahead and create a test, which they eventually ended up doing, if they'd have done that from the start, they would have had a shot to contain this. So they forgot they were in a time of, they didn't know how to operate in a time of crisis. They were operating as if things were just going on normally. And that's bad leadership. That's a mistake.
Let me play a couple of clips. Here is Joe Biden on the matter of vaccines in an exchange with ABC News congressional correspondent Mary Bruce last month.
Trust the scientists. It's one thing for Donald Trump to say the vaccine is safe. Okay, then give it to the board of scientists. Have total transparency so independent operators and scientists and companies go out and take a look at it. And what did you base that decision on? What did you do? Did you pressure the head of the FDA? Did you pressure whomever? I'm not saying he would or will, but that's what has to happen. Because you know yourself, you all know the polls better than I do. The American people right now don't trust what the president says about things relating to science.
And if the scientists say a vaccine under the president's watch is safe and effective, absolutely, people take it?
Do it. Yes. If those three questions I laid out can be answered, yes. Absolutely.
Joe Biden with Mary Bruce from ABC in September. And I guess we should say that here we sit 4 days before Election Day, Andy, and no vaccine. So the president really wanted to be able to have a big October surprise, or maybe we'll still get it as an extremely early November surprise, but at this point I doubt it. So is this a result of independence from the CDC and the FDA standing up and saying, no, this is not ready, so you can't say it's ready, and he was trying to, or is there any political dynamic or assertion of independence by the science agencies that you can attribute this to?
Well, number one, they didn't receive an application. And the reason they didn't receive an application is because the vaccine data wasn't ready. And, you know, the reason that Trump's statement was absurd is not because we don't want a vaccine as early as possible. It's because you can't set a time and say we're going to do it on this date. What has to happen is there's 30,000 people that have been given the vaccine or a placebo, and they have to be exposed. There has to be enough exposure to COVID-19 for you to have enough data. And that doesn't happen on a magical date. That happens based upon when those 30,000 people get their exposure. So, and then by the way, if they get their exposure and there is some sort of event, and a safety event or some other thing, they have to stop and look at it. So what was offensive to people was that a politician who is not evaluating all of those ins and outs were saying, we'll have it by a certain date. And I think Joe Biden's right. If it happens October 25th or November 1st or November 2nd, if that was the right decision, if the data is ready, that's far more important than politics. And I think Joe Biden would have said, great, let's do that. And the fact is, we're probably towards the end of November before we have the first application. Best case, I think we'll probably have one, maybe two applications in by then. And then the FDA did, to their credit, resist Trump's efforts to politicize the decision by saying we are going to be very, very stringent about our decision making. And the reason is, Brian, if I could say this, there is a huge asset that we have that we can't squander, and that's called trust in vaccines. If you have a vaccine that works 100%, well, but nobody takes it, it doesn't matter. So the process is as important as anything else.
Let's take a phone call from a caller who I think is a Trump supporter with a kind of question from a Trump perspective that I was going to ask you anyway. Let's let a caller do it if he does it. Andy in Astoria, you're on WNYC with Andy Slavitt. Andy, meet Andy. Thank you for calling in.
Yeah. Hi, Brian. I love your show. I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller. It's not that I'm a Trump supporter, but what I got to say is that this is the biggest lie the left has ever pushed to us. Because I've talked to a lot of, my job makes me talk to a lot of doctors. You know, I've talked to a lot of pulmonologists and infectious disease specialists. This virus cannot be controlled. Stop lying and telling people you can't control this virus. The only thing you can do is minimize the spread, but you cannot control, you cannot eradicate this virus. You know, Europe is the biggest example. They took the drastic measures out there and see what happened. I mean, you cannot control this virus. Stop telling people we can control this virus.
What's the difference, as you use the words, Andy, between control and minimize the spread? When you're trying to control the virus, isn't that what you're trying to do, minimize the spread?
Yeah.
Well,
Let me ask the caller. Andy, the caller.
Oh,
go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Well, you got to put that in perspective because, you know, the government is not only the Department of Health. You know, the government is Department of Agriculture, of the economy. So we got to put that in perspective. Yes, we got to take some drastic measures, but are those measures worse than the cure? So are we going to kill the economy or are we going to kill whatever we worked for so far? Mm-hmm. Just to minimize the spread of a disease that is going to end up spreading anyhow. I mean,
Andy, I'm going to leave it. I gotcha. Please call us again. Yeah. Thank you very much for this call. And really, that question, Andy Slavitt, he took it to the second level at the end. It's not that you can't control the virus. It's that the economic pain and other kinds of ill effects from controlling the virus with hard lockdowns might be worse than the disease. I mean, we've been debating that on the show, you know, day after day for months. But he cites Europe as an example. And here we are with, as you know, Europe rising ahead of the United States now. We're probably a few weeks behind them like we were in the spring. And hard lockdowns coming in France, more of a lockdown than Germany had previously, I believe, and other countries in Europe, and they don't have Donald Trump.
So it's a very fair question, and it's a very fair debate, and good for the caller, Andy, and good for you for having a forum for that. But let's look at the facts. Where he's right is COVID-19 cannot be eradicated. It can't be eradicated with the tools we have today. But it can be controlled. He points to Europe. Let me point to Africa. Africa is no stranger to infectious diseases, loses hundreds of thousands of people to infectious diseases all the time. This particular infectious disease, there's 1.3 billion people in Africa, 35,000 deaths. Look at Hong Kong, which is the closest neighbor to China, has the most cross-border traffic with China. There's been about 100 deaths. The question is why? And the answer has a lot to do with people's experience controlling diseases like this. This is not a particularly complex disease. With all respect to the pulmonologists that Andy's talked to, this is not a hard disease to control the spread of. It requires behavior change, and that's not easy. But it's all about not breathing near one another. It's a respiratory disease. When we thought it spread a lot through things people touched, it was much more complex. It's not. So You wear a mask like people slapped on in Hong Kong right away. You don't breathe near one another, and you don't spread it. I don't think there's very much question left about the science of reducing the spread. There's a lot of questions about the sociology, about people in the U.S. having supposed COVID fatigue, about people who just want to live their lives, creating alternate theories. But the truth is that the deaths are being concentrated among the working class population, and they're happening rapidly and more rapidly, and they're not happening with people who have the privilege of being able to seclude themselves. Right. They're only spreading the virus. So a little bit of empathy and understanding into those communities would help people say, hey, wait a minute, I can change my behavior a little bit. It can make an enormous difference. You absolutely can control the spread and reduce the spread. It's being done all over the world.
So last question, real quick. We just have a minute left. Then we're going to have the news and our weekly Ask the Mayor segment. Folks, Mayor Bill de Blasio, there's news on schools and the virus and other things. A 5-second clip of Jared Kushner back in April talking about a federal stockpile that people were pushing for of masks for healthcare workers and other PPE. 5 seconds of Jared Kushner.
The notion of the federal stockpile was it's supposed to be our stockpile. It's not supposed to be state stockpiles that they then use.
It's supposed to be state stockpiles. And that's been a centerpiece of Trump administration policy, trying to say this is the state's responsibility, not the federal government. In 30 seconds, if Biden comes in and changes that, how much can it become a federal response in a way that it isn't now? How much of that is even realistic to expect?
It needs to be a partnership. I mean, what the Trump administration did is they did something called the state authority handoff, is what they called it, where they believed they could wash their hands and end the task force. What you want is a president who says, I'm not going to sleep at night as long as people are dying from this, as long as people don't have PPE, as long as we don't have the things we need in the country, and then works hand in hand in accountability with the states and local officials. You want a federal government that sets the guideline, procures the materials, makes things easier so states aren't bidding against one another, and then let states apply stuff locally. I think that's the right model. I think that's what Joe Biden would do if he were to become president.
And that is our 30 Issues in 30 Days election series for this year. Issue 30, Politics and the CDC. We thank Andy Slavitt, former administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, author of the forthcoming book, Preventable, the Inside Story of How Leadership Failures, Politics, and Selfishness Doomed the U.S. Coronavirus Response. And he hosts a podcast called In the Bubble. Andy, thank you so much. I hope you'll keep coming on with us.
Of course. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.